Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Men on the Rocks. It is I, Ristic's best friend, Joe. Joining me, as always, we have Talion's loyal defender, Atlas.
Hello, everybody.
This week, we got a bit of a broad topic, a bit of a fun topic. Everyone wants to talk about CDH this, CDH that, but no one wants to talk about what makes something CDH. Be it the deck, the player, or the card, every one of these little bits and pieces is going to fit into that pie a little bit differently. We kind of go over that. Then we also talk about how they shouldn't ban Ristic Study, because that's a really silly argument. What isn't a silly argument, though, is these announcements. Atlas, what are these non-silly announcements we got?
So, of course, classic stuff, just like usual. We got tournaments coming up, since we're in a new season here. February 10th. CDH, Return of the King, CDH 4. Sign up if you haven't already.
Plenty of spots available.
Yeah, there's plenty of spots available, so we want to fill those up because the tournament's great, the organizers are great, it's a really great group of people up there. The players are really competitive, the matches are really fun, and both the Man on the Rocks boys are going to be there.
Yeah, we are.
So come see us, play some games with us, you can chat magic, you can give us your hot takes, and we'll tell you the latest of ours. Then the next weekend, February 17th is the OCCS, which is the Olympic Commander Challenger Series.
Home game!
Home games at Gabby's Olympic Cards and Comics, which is our home store. So that's going to be really cool. Hopefully some of y'all can make it to that, because once again, lots of really competitive players, and we would love to see you guys show up and help support something that we love, which is our shop. Mm-hmm. Then I got one more here. This one comes before all of that. So, and it's going to be a little late notice because when this episode drops, it will be tomorrow. But on February 2nd, this Friday, Sound Gaming Showdown is in Tacoma. This is from a newer tournament organizer. They're trying to start a new CDH scene in Tacoma, Washington. Great person is doing the tournament organizing. Their name's Kyle, and they've organized a lot of like charity tournaments in the past and stuff like that. So they're looking for people to help support their game, their game store, and increase their tournament turnout. This one's a little different in that it is a February. It fires off in the evening at 6 p.m. It's at Defiant Fox Games in Tacoma, so you can find this information online. But check that out. It's a $20 buy-in. Starting in the evening, they're going to do like a cash payout and like have some promos and stuff. And it should be a really good time. Unfortunately, I won't be able to be there at this one, but hopefully some of you all can make it and support them. And they're going to be doing more of these just before the weekend type tournaments in the future. So we will be sure to keep you posted, and I'm sure I will be showing up to some of them as I hear about them and give you guys future announcements. But that's everything that's coming up, aside from Punt City. I will be there. Unfortunately, Joe will not be able to make it this time.
But
Punt City 3, me and a couple of other players from our local area are traveling over there. We're going to play some games, hopefully show everyone what the West Coast meta is all about, and hope to do well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lucky patron shout out this week. Shout out to Dylan. Appreciate you, buddy. You should come on down. Get a drink with us.
All right, what does make something CDH?
You know, that's a really good question. That's a very good question. One that like I keep tinkering around with in my brain, because I come to almost like two kind of conclusions with it. Sometimes it's the deck, most of the times I think it's the pilot, right? I think what makes like a deck, okay, let's back this up a bit further. I think there are kind of like three different categories you can kind of like put that question in context with, and I think all of them are going to have very different answers. What makes any given card CDH, what makes any given deck CDH, and kind of piloting kind of shifts between those two and kind of operates on its own in sort of a way.
Uh-huh.
Because like we were talking about clones, like, and you know, we were talking about like clones are kind of huge in CDH right now, just because the One Ring, and why would you run this other card when you can just run a clone that could potentially be a copy of any other creature on the board, or any other creature that you have like access to, or in the case like Metamorph, the One Ring, for example, being able to copy that seems pretty good. You know, where's kind of the bar for that? You know, what makes a card CDH viable, I guess? What makes it like a legitimate choice in the space. And that kind of extends further to the rest of our 99. You know, what makes a deck CDH? Where is that threshold? Is that threshold on card 70, card 71? Is it arbitrary? Is it in the philosophy? Or is it in like the means in which you pilot a deck? You know?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think part of it is like, there's a difference between like the way that you're playing and like you're playing competitively.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can like necessarily narrow it down to as simply as like we're playing CEDH, like necessarily, unless all the three of those things align, right? Because if you're like, oh, we're playing CEDH, but everyone's just like playing super competitively and is a really good player, but you're all using out of the box precons, like you're not playing CEDH.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay. So let's take that example. Let's push it to the point that we are playing CDH. Where is that breaking point? Where is that line?
It's gotta be something like when you start abusing the most efficient win cons. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a line necessarily, but I think there's probably a metric you could set, right?
Definitely.
Sort of like a legal precedent thing where you're like, okay, this is the threshold of when something becomes CDH. When it meets this threshold, that's when it's competitive. So you'd be like, when you're working to achieve the most consistent win rate possible after, like, something about, that's so hard, but like,
it's right,
like,
it's a tough question,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it is. I feel like it's there. It's something about like constructing your deck to abuse the most broken cards and like playing to like min-max your wins as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's CDH, but then also you got to throw in a line about like playing for the community or something there too, because that's also part of the format, so spirit of the format type deal.
Yeah, I feel like that it, to some degree, kind of just falls into like the arms of like Commander, the spirit of Commander. I mean, EDH is still Commander, CDH is still Commander at the end of the day.
But CDH, you mean casual EDH?
Casual EDH, whoa! More like cheater EDH, got him! I'm still going to get mileage out of that for like the next little while. It's simply too good. I think consistency ends up being like, I guess, the easiest smoking gun to point to, where you have tuned like a deck and you have tuned your play style in order to accomplish this very, I guess, specific set of goals.
It does a thing, and it does that one thing very well.
Ruthless efficiency, and single-minded at that sometimes. Yeah, I can see that, but also, like, high power exists, you know, where, like, you can tune a high-powered list to be pretty consistent, pretty single-minded in, like, what it does. I mean, just because, you know, we're I'm just going to stick to basic examples here. Just because we're pretty single-minded Thoracle Breach Adnaz, you know, doesn't mean that like high power can't be, I don't know, like what's a good high power strategy? Like pick one. You know,
bro,
where
I,
is
I do not know.
Yeah, I couldn't name you one. I don't know, like
Land Destruction. Is ramp? You play like I'm ramp? Gonna cast my cultivate, yeah, seven times. Is that,
yeah,
high power?
I'm gonna loop Solemn Simulacrum as much as possible. God, yeah. It was like one of my first few decks I made was Alicia Who Smiles at Death. I was the happiest camper in the world when I had a Sack Owlet and a Solemn Simulacrum in the graveyard and an Alicia on the battlefield. Every single turn I would swing, pay the trigger, get Solemn out, get a basic, sack it, draw a card. Ugh,
so good.
Sick value for days. But like that, like even then, like I at one point had that deck pretty tuned out. It was missing a lot of like the fast mana pieces, and this was before like fire design. So think like 2014 through like 2016 era Magic, where pretty much any tutor I got access to, any black tutor won me the game, because I would just find Buried Alive and just do a Buried Alive combo. You know, would that be CDH? I wasn't playing a lot of like the hyper consistent cards. I wasn't playing all the fast mana. Hardly knew that fast mana existed or thought it was good, you know?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it's hard. But like, I think there's also that line, right, where you hit like your high power, but like you're not actually high power, you're just fringe CDH.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I feel like I'm like you're just like on a little bit different build. Because there are decks out there that look like casual lists when you're looking at a deck list. And then they put up these results in tournaments, or like you play against them and you're going, holy heck, what the heck? Like, yeah, I know Tatiova says draw cards on it, but like you're playing like 36 lands, right? Like what, how is this doing the thing?
36 lands, all these random ramp cards, like what are you doing?
Yeah. And so I think there's some degree of that too, is like, you can't be too high power and high power. I don't know. I'm personally of the mind, I don't think high power exists anymore. I think there is competitive and then there is casual. And I think the main thing that differentiates them, apart from the tune, like the degree to which a list is tuned, where if it's tuned, it can be tuned a little in casual, like you have a theme or something. Yeah. That's tuning. Yeah. But you can't be like, okay, these are the most optimal cards. This is the most effective way, like you said, to consistently, ruthlessly, consistently get to the point where I'm winning the game. I think as soon as you hit that point, you're not casual anymore. And you're even if you're not playing all of the most efficient things, like you don't have to be playing Grixis Breach or like Turbo Mardu or whatever it is in order to be playing a competitive list. It just has to be like, I'm going to get here and I'm going to do it by doing it this way. And in that regard, I think like Tatiova is a pretty good example, because that deck plays fast mana, but it's not like stacked up on rocks or something, because you're just trying to dump a bunch of lands.
Definitely. You're looking to land your commander and just landfall your way to victory.
Yeah. And so, but like, if you look at that list on like Moxfield or something, it's not going to look like a quote unquote competitive list necessarily. It's going to have a lot of ways to interact. Maybe that's the piece that we're missing. It's like interaction.
And that's kind of where like I start to go. Cause I think if we want to stick to casual competitive, this is the binary in which we're going to operate for the sake of this particular argument. Not a lot of interactions run in casual. You don't see a lot of
sorcery speed, it's all really sorcery fair rate.
Yeah. Or like, it's expensive, but it does a lot, a la, what's the whiteboard wipe? Farewell, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Those style of effects where you're paying a slightly higher cost on the spell, but you're getting a pretty good bang for the buck, or it's like pretty modal and pretty flexible in what it does. But you're paying that like two extra mana on it for like an effect that, you know, in CDH land, we'd go, well, if your interaction's more than three mana, what are you doing?
Or it's all colorless or something. All color pipped, I should say.
Yeah, or like it's super color intensive, and it's great and it's wonderful. Love that exists. But I think the amount of interaction is required when the threat and speed of a format gets to a kind of breaking point. Legacy is allowed to have Force of Will because you can turn one out. You can turn one ad nauseum tentacles people. You need ways in order to stop that, and those strategies are allowed to exist in that format because those safeguards exist. For the longest time, Modern was a turn four format. So everything was kind of centered around that sort of thing. The classic line of CDH is a turn three format kind of facilitates like a high degree and like a really efficient means of interacting with the game. Now, granted, turn three in CDH, I think, means something completely different from like a turn four, like Splinter Twin combo in Modern. But I think that's where we kind of pull in that like efficiency for your game plan is turn three. You really want your game plan to be established, or you really want to be online on turn three.
Oh yeah, you have to be relevant to the game by turn
two. I think relevant is the word I think is more apt these days, because if turn three goes by and you aren't threatening something, stopping something, or trying to position yourself, what are you doing?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're just kind of sitting there and dirtling. But I think that the relevancy is an important part, because you don't necessarily have to be in a winning state, but you've set up a board where no one else is either, or like they can't get there before they deal with X or something like that.
Or there's something to worry about, or the you know, someone just vamp tutored, or though that kind of like thinking.
Yeah. That said, I did see I had a turn two Thorkell attempt in one of my games I was playing earlier today.
It happens. Like, we're in a game where we have Mana Crypt, Lotus Petal, LED.
Oh yeah, it was land, Lotus Petal, land on turn two, and then they just went raw Thorkell Consul.
Yeah. Sometimes that happens.
Yeah. I mean, that is Mental Misstep exists for that reason.
It exactly does. But I guess that's like kind of a closer indicator, is like the speed in which and like the efficiency of our win cons, and the tools in which people are able to use to combat them. You know,
what if we say possible? Absolutely.
It means that like we all don't die turn one or turn two because Mental Misstep, because Flusterstorm, because force of will, all of the free interaction that we all really like using, it's allowed to exist because you can put a win attempt out pretty early. You can storm pretty early in our format.
Right. Well, that's what I was saying is what the piece we're missing is our definition for competitive is like, what if it's possible to demonstrate a win on turn two? Because I don't think it's even possible. Your casual deck would have to be really, really weird if
very
you
weird.
Casually demonstrate a win on turn two.
Very good draw. Very, very good draw.
Yeah, something wild out there. But because I think that's maybe that's like relevant, possible. Like it's possible to demonstrate a win on turn two, depending on the deck. So it's something you have mm-hmm. to be ready for. So like even if your deck can't do it, just acknowledge that it's possible to lose the game on two in this format.
Built with respect to the turn two kill.
Even, I think you could even lose on one in theory, right? If someone has like perfect seven.
Yeah, I mean what, like lands.
Or like land.
Land, Lotus Petal.
Lotus Petal.
Know, like dark Crit into like, I don't know, like.
I don't think it can be Dark Crit, right? It has to be like land, Lotus Petal, Chrome Mox with a pitch card.
And then Thoracle Consult.
Thoracle Consult. Yeah. Yeah.
That's six either cards that right or there. Like, it's pretty easy to make three double black on turn one and just add Nos and then figure it out from there. But even still, like, you still have to get off to the races in some way. So you still need, like, Lotus Petal, Chrome Mox, Mana Crypt, or something like that.
Oh, you could also do, like, Dark Ritual, Signet, Lotus Petal, Thoracle Consult.
Yeah, something like that.
Something crazy like that.
Some insane combination that makes every Nos player like just go ballistic.
Yeah, right. These things that don't come up ever because they just don't happen. And when they do, someone's holding endurance for you. Or mental mistake.
Every time. Yeah. Interaction and intent, I feel like, are pretty, pretty big with it. I mean, because the whole reason I think CDH has gotten as well received, is that the word I want to use? Yeah, let's go with received and grown, is because, like, when we sit down at a table and we say we are playing CDH, that's a pretty particular style of Magic and a very particular kind of, like, commander that we're playing.
Yeah, it's come to encompass a lot of, like, the philosophy behind how you play, too.
Yeah, no, 100%. And
it's
that's
just,
where...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, go for it.
We're not just here to, like... We're here to win, but we're not just here to just... Oh, make you have a bad time because I want to do my thing on turn two.
No. And it happens, but ultimately, like, it's cool that it happens, but it's also really cool when it gets stopped and the game continues.
Yes, absolutely. And personally, I think it's far more cool.
Oh, I agree. I very much enjoy when the win attempt early gets stopped and, like, the game is able to progress to, like, a mid and a late game where we can enjoy kind of the full spectrum of Magic the Gathering, where every stage of the game is relevant for one reason or another. You know, the aggro decks and combo decks have their attempts early. You know, mid-range and control decks really start getting a grasp on the resources and starting to pull ahead, and then late game the control decks dominate. Like, that's beautiful style of game when you get to experience kind of the rainbow of deck archetypes, as it were.
Absolutely, yeah.
So then player intention that matters then would in kind of like the conversation in the space, because we are intending to play this style of game. Like that is our intention. That is the things that we come to expect of ourselves and of our opponents when we sit down at a table.
Yeah, I think it definitely does. And like I said, I think philosophy, like, around what this format is, what to expect when people say CDH, is like has a large part to do with why the format has been so widely accepted, has gotten so popular. I think that philosophy and, like, sort of like trying to standardize that philosophy to some degree of, like, hey guys, this is what we're looking to accomplish with this format. This is how we kind of want to play the game, is high degrees of interaction. We want to, like, try and do really cool, really powerful things. So if you're just trying to, like, play Cultivate for seven turns in a row and then cast one huge spell, that's awesome, but this is probably not the table you want to sit down at.
Would you say that, like, those are, like, the guiding philosophies and principles of CDH that you would say then?
I think so, for the most part. It's like, you're trying to win, you're trying to, like, play it as well as you possibly can, because you're trying to win, and you're looking for a challenging, a fun, and a very high-powered game. Like, you play a lot of crazy broken cards in this format, and there aren't a lot of other formats where they let you do that.
That's true. Okay. I guess I'm interested in, like, the transition from, like, I guess, fringe CDH since high power doesn't exist in this conversation, Fringe CDH to CDH proper then? Because it sounds like there's a pathway taken.
Why do you think that Fringe CDH isn't CDH proper? Because that's where I would take issues. Like, I think just because you're playing a Fringe deck does not mean you're not playing like true CDH.
Oh, I guess I'm not saying that like it doesn't exist, but it would it be different or is it all the same?
I think it's all the same. I think it's just a matter of like at that point, it's just a matter of like deck construction, and so it's like it more has to do with like pre-game knowledge about like different cards and how they interact and like why you're selecting this card over that card, mm-hmm. and or maybe it has to do with like somebody's like really passionate about a pet card, and so they're gonna include that card no matter what and like try and play it to the best of their ability, try to win with that card for sure, but it's maybe not like the mathematically the most correct thing to be playing or something like that. Not the meta call. I think that's a good way to put it. I don't think that those people are playing any less CDH than people who are playing like just net deck TK.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because going back to like an earlier point that you said, you know, you look at these decks that are like these pile of cards that make you go like, what the heck? This is CDH. I think like there are two different decks that pop to mind. One I think is Winota, and I think Winota is a really good like smell test for a lot of people, because me and you know what Winota is. We're very, very familiar with what Winota is.
Oh, yes, painfully so.
Painfully so, and nothing is more CDH than Winota. But to, I guess, the unseasoned eye, it does look like just a pile of cards. Like, what are all these random creatures, these two ones that say your opponents can't do things? Like, how is this CDH?
How is this effective? How is this winning the game? Yeah. No, I can see that. I can for sure see that. And I think it really just comes down to, like, at that point, like, once, like, you're like, oh, yeah, this is not CDH. And then you play against it or you see it in action or something. You're like, okay, well, I was mistaken. This deck has legs. There's some serious, like, there's some cooking going on here. And I gotta gotta respect that. Even if it is a little fringe.
What is the cooking? What is the cheftitude that makes it go then?
What?
So, like, you see Winota in action. Like, what is making that, like, CDH tick?
It's winning.
It's winning.
Yeah, it's winning very efficiently with the cards that it's playing. And I think that ticks exactly the boxes that we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. The efficiency, consistency, and intention.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you build the deck with the intention of having some degree of consistency, like ruthless consistency, and you're playing to win, and the deck is doing that. I think that pretty much makes the deck CDH.
Okay. The other deck I want to throw kind of at this smell test is your Kenrith list, because I also think from an outside observer, is Winota-like in the sense that this is just kind of a pile of cards. Like, there's not really, like, I thought CDH was, you know, like, Adnaz Breach, whatever, and this is wholly different.
I think it can definitely be that, but once again, I think it comes down to, like, what's the intention with the construction? Why are these cards good? Is it winning? Is it doing the thing that it wants to do consistently? And if the answer is like, once again, if the answer is yes to all of those questions, then I think that makes it CDH, even if it is different, fringe, off meta. Because that's the word that I think I'm looking for, is off meta. It's like for a lot of these decks that, where it's like, what the heck is this? Like there was I just got sent a list for a top 16 that somebody had while playing Child of Alara this past weekend.
What?
At a tournament. Yeah, and they took second place at this tournament playing Child of Alara. It was not the Boil, but it was a smaller, like, more local tournament. But they took second place playing Child of Alara, and I looked at this deck, and I was like, the fuck is this shit? Like, they got, like, all these stacks pieces jammed in there, basically no fast mana. I think they were on, like, two, like, Saurian Mana Crypt or something like that. There are zero combos. There's just, like, jammed full of creatures and a bunch of ways to kill the child and stuff like that. You're just like, what the heck? But then at the same time, like, obviously they did well. They took second place at this event. So the deck performs, at least to some degree, consistently, and it's winning games. So you can't say it's not CDH. It's just super off-meta. Super, like, fringe, off-meta. Like, it's playing cards that are built to beat meta cards because it's more of, like, a stacks deck.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the thing, is like a lot of people say, oh, this card doesn't win the game. It's like, and that card may not win the game, and I'm only playing like one combo or no combos in this case, but all my other cards say stop you from winning the game, and that's good enough, because if you're not winning the game, I can still win the game. And when your deck is built to stop everyone else from ever getting their window, that means that your window becomes the entire course of the game until people's hit points reach zero. And I think that that's a really important thing to remember, is that just because you don't see why a deck is good, or when you like build it and play it and it's, you're like, this deck is terrible, doesn't mean that like the, for the person who didn't construct it, it doesn't like perfectly match with their playstyle. We talk about that multiplicative effect of like matching a playstyle of a player with a deck, and I think that that counts for a lot.
Yeah. So one tournament makes a deck CDH.
I think it can. I think there's like, you have to go over a range of time. So like, no, in that sense, no. One tournament does not make a deck CEDH. But I don't think that you can discount a deck that's calling itself CEDH just because it only won one tournament, or it's won zero tournaments, or it hasn't ever like topped or something like that. Like, that's not necessarily true. It might be that the deck is missing like one card to like push it over the edge to the point where it's going to start like just closing all these games out and moving up the ranks, or that it just hasn't like been fully tuned yet. Like, it's not still not a casual list, but it just hasn't been figured out.
No, like not enough like time or discovery has been like put into it. Not enough like
trial and error. Well, it's not, maybe like the time thing, I guess, is always a factor, right? But it's just enough trial and error. Like, you haven't played enough games with it. You haven't tested enough cards to figure out what works and what doesn't yet. Because I think that there are some cards out there where it's like, this can't realistically, like, you can call it CEDH this. I'm thinking to like EDH Rec right now, where you go and like pick like mono red or mono blue or something like that, and you'll see all these legends that pop up from like old sets, and these cards are just like, they're either vanilla or they're terrible, or they have like unpayable mana costs or something. And you could like, yeah man, you can go and play like the Starn Twins or whatever those
that Stang.
Stang. Is that, Stang. Yeah, go play Stang or something like that. You'd be like, yeah, this is CDH Stang. It's like, okay, what's your deck do? Oh, it uses Gruul Snoop, and it doesn't use its commander in any meaningful way, and it doesn't have, the commander is just there to be the commander. The deck is what makes it CDH. Like, you can't say that the deck is like, it's Gruul this at that point. It's not like this is the commander that makes this deck CDH or viable, right? Like, you got Winota. It's a good example. Winota makes that deck CDH. You cannot play that deck without Winota. It just doesn't work. It's a different deck if you're trying to make it work. But then you also see decks like Kinnan. Same thing, right? Where it's going super fast, super I win the gamey, very meta. But that deck, once again, you can't just be like Simic Ramp. Like, there are a lot of ways to do Simic Ramp, and none of them are going to be as good. Because then you got like, you got Kinnan, it's gonna do it with Basalt Monolith and like rocks and stuff, but you also got like Simic Ramp in the form of like two trees and things like that. So they're more specific to their commanders. But then on the other end of the spectrum, be like, okay, well, I'm playing Grixis, like Grixis Breach, Grixis this, Grixis that. And it's like, yeah, okay, maybe Rograt contributes something a little extra to the game plan compared to like Kess or Inala or something like that.
Yeah.
Inala's not really a good equation there, because she does contribute something
pretty unique. I would say that it kind of passes that like commander requirement to do something in CDH.
Yeah.
It provides a unique line and a unique access to what it does that the other Grixis decks just can't.
Kind of, in a way. But I think, once again, it just boils down to like, you're just playing Grixis Breach Thoracle ad nauseum. Like, you're just playing the Grixis staple stuff. Your deck is solved. You're not making any innovations. It's just kind of there. Like, you can change to off of one Grixis commander, and you can go play another one, and 95% of your list is going to be identical. The only thing you've changed is the commander. And I think at that point, it's like, well, okay, you're not playing CDH Stang. You're playing CDH Gruul Pile. You're playing CDH Grixis Pile. And I think that's just something that's worth noting when we're talking about like what these commanders are contributing.
How is it important that a commander, I guess it, in a way it is important that a commander is able to contribute something to the game plan.
I mean, I think it's obviously beneficial. You're leaving,
definitely beneficial,
you're leaving potential on the table if it's not. But
yeah.
I think at the same time, like, you're not necessarily, it's not to say your deck isn't CDH. You just can't be like, guys, I'm playing CDH Stang when you're playing CDH Gruul Pile. You can't call the deck something that it's not. Like, unless Stang serves a purpose, unless Stang belongs in the deck, it's you could swap it out and you could be technically better served by playing like Rurik Thar or Aranis Street Urchin or something like that. And I think that that's one of the important points about the discussion of what makes a deck CDH is it does not have to be the commander. It's the deck.
So it's the deck that makes something CDH. The commander is occasionally secondary, but mostly like the main reason why you're there for a given deck.
Yeah, I think so. I think commanders can be icing on the... Well, yes.
No. I like that. It's icing on the cake.
Commanders are icing on the cake. Like, if your deck is not CDH, playing a quote-unquote CDH commander is not going to save you. The deck is still going to be not... It's still going to be casual. It's still going to be bad. Mm-hmm. You can be playing Rogrek and Silas right in the command zone, but if you're running, like, 6 12 costs and 45 lands, so you can cast those 12 costs, and then, like, a couple of counterspells, even if they're free counterspells, that does not make your deck CDH. Like, not unless you've found a way to break that and make it super consistent and really powerful, and these cards are going to consistently win you the game. It's like a twofold.
You just, like, slap it on there like that.
Yeah, it's like a twofold condition. Like, you can't say, my commander is CDH when your deck is doing all the work. And you can't say, my deck is CDH when your commander is doing all the work. Right? And those two things have to, like, find a little happy partnership where your deck and your commander are, like, both CDH. And so then you can be like, okay, this is my competitive blah, blah, blah. It's a CDH deck. Otherwise, you're like, you just go by the colors. If your commander
Otherwise, you're playing CDH Stang.
Otherwise, you're playing CDH Stang.
No, I think that's a really good point to make, because I think when you look at like the requirements for like a card and to an extent like a commander, like figuring out what makes the cut, I think is incredibly important. I mean, you look at like the prevalence of the partner commanders, you know, Thrasios, Timna, Krom, Tevish. If we really want to count Rograk as something applicable, Rograk, but that's only because I want to shit on Rograk. They all do provide something, be it generic, but they give you something. They at least give the deck at least some amount of direction for card choice, which I think is important. I think it's a good part of CDH that I think is still very good and very healthy and exists still. The fact that you do have to find those really good Timna attackers that fit in with your game plan. The fact that Thrasios is an outlet in the command zone. The fact that Jessica is an outlet in the command zone. The fact that Tevish is a game plan in and of itself that will take over the game. These very malleable pieces that you have access to, both in the command zone and your deck, I think is a super, super big requirement.
Unfortunately, it's not as much as one of those I wish it was, but I feel like that's really slacking lately. If anyone from, once again, R&D, you're listening, please print commanders that encourage deck building restrictions.
I agree.
Please.
I agree. I have been saying it forever, ever since I entered CDH and I saw Tim McCrom, like, yep, you're just playing generic draw in the command zone with 98 really good cards that all win the game.
Yeah, either that or like commanders with like so much potential of what they can do that like there are a billion different ways to build them. So not all the lists are going to be the same. It's not super solved. Like,
yeah.
TK, like, yeah, your TK list is 6 cards different, 6 to 15 cards different. That's still a solved deck. I want to be able to go and play like a commander that says Turbo Nas on one end of the spectrum, and it's just like hard stacks on the other one. And I don't know which one I'm sitting down against right up until they play like their first 3 cards. And I think that's actually, talking about Rograk and Tevishaw, I think that's one of my favorite things about that commander pairing. I think they're actually super well constructed, just because like
you have both you don't know. To play with. Yeah.
You don't know. You're either playing Turbo Stacks and they're just trying to lock you down, or they're trying to win the game on turn 2 and you're not sure which. And while both of them, like, you can interact similarly, they have different game plans, different ways to that you're supposed to beat them. So I think it's just one of those unique things where it's one of the unique pairings in partner where that's actually the case, as opposed to just pile.
Absolutely. And to touch on partners for a little bit, I think that they have expanded the partners to like being like the specific groupings. I think the Doctor Who commanders, the Stranger Things kids, I think are a fantastic way to handle partners going forward. I never want to see the word partner printed on another card again, nor should it, unless it's like monocolor and doesn't do anything. Because what, the last time we got generic partners was Yoshimaru, I think?
Maybe? I don't actually remember. It was,
sure.
Yeah,
it was a while ago. They don't happen frequently. They don't happen frequently, and they never make much of a splash.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going with yes, with the blind confidence of someone who is 100% wrong that Yoshimaru is the last generic partner.
Correct us in the comments below.
Correct us in the comments below. Yell at us in the Discord. Blah 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 blah. So I guess the question then turns to what makes an individual card like CDH worthy, and by extension, like what makes a particular Commander CDH worthy is kind of. I feel like we kind of explained that the whole Stang versus like any other like Gruul commander. I feel like that's a pretty straightforward like example and explanation to that. But I think the main board choice of card and like the requirement for that card to be CDH, I think, is substantially more interesting, because I think you can break it down into a couple of categories. You have ramp, you have interaction, you have win condition and value engine, and I guess stacks piece.
Stacks piece adjacent.
I guess if you want to throw in another category, tutors, but I feel like that can kind of be slotted into like win conditions tutors kind of encompass everything, I think. Because I think ideally.
Tutoring is its own slot.
It's kind of its own slot. But it's kind of not its own slot, because a tutor is just a theoretical additional copy of whatever its tutor pool is in the given deck. It's consistency to the deck, that ruthless consistency that we really want for a deck. I guess you can count it as its own category, because there are tutors that we choose to play and choose not to play.
That's kind of where I was like taking it. It's like I don't know. Whenever I'm building a deck, at least I always look at it like, all right, if this many tutors, do I really want more than like 10 tutors, 11 tutors? Mm-hmm.
Like the best tutors.
Because otherwise you're like, okay, well, I hit another tutor, but it wasn't like the best tutor in my deck. So now I have to wait another turn before I can cast this card. And then I have to get the card, and then I have to go get the other card. And just like all those things. It's like, I like playing tutors because they feel really good. But at the same time, I don't really want to cast one.
Yeah, but like there is that kind of like sliding scale, that reason like you're not playing a like idyllic tutor and enlightened tutor, for example.
You're not?
I might be. Honestly, you can turn one an idyllic tutor and put a Rhystic Study in hand. You can also do the same thing. Turn two the Rhystic Study. But like Enlightened Tutor can accomplish the same thing in that scenario, and you operate in instant speed, and it has benefits. But like that exact like dichotomy is the reason like why there is like a threshold for any given card category, for the reason why we're playing these things. Because I think it's pretty easy to start off with, okay, these are kind of like, I guess, like the tiers of cards. Yeah, let's use the word tiers. Removal interaction, I think, is a pretty easy like kind of category to explain this. There's a reason you start off with Force of Will for your counterspell. It's generic. You're playing it. It can be used literally any time. It stops literally anything for free, minus the pitch cost and the life cost. Swords to Plowshares in a similar means. It is the most efficient way to clear anything the best with the least amount of downside. And then from there, things kind of spiderweb out. Sticking with counterspells, we have like Force Negation, Fierce Guardianship, Mind Break Trap, Mental Misstep. For like our free stuff, then you get into the spells that start costing mana. Swan Song. I put Flusterstorm in the free category, if not Flusterstorm. Offer, you know, those things. And you kind of go, almost like you said, do I really want to run that 12th counter spell? I got 10 of the best ones right here. Do I really need that?
Do I want to draw another one when I could draw something else instead? Because these will cover all my bases.
Exactly. And I think the requirement for any given card in kind of the broad categories that I explained is it's a very like fight for your life kind of thing, because I think a lot of those categories kind of just have like their best cards already like pretty known and accepted at this point. I feel like
pretty much been locked in unless something new is printed.
Pretty locked in. Yeah. I mean, the last time we had like a major shakeup I'll stick with interaction in this category for a while. It was like offer. I think it was like the last really big piece of interaction we got.
Oh yeah, and all you haters out there who said giving your opponent's mana loses you the game, look at you now. Swansong's strictly better my booty.
It has lost me the game, but also I have won significantly more games off the back of it than I have lost it at this point. So how does that kind of like work for you then when you look at a given card? We were talking before we started about your fickle nature with Tashana's Tidebinder.
Dude, that card is so good and also so bad.
Why?
It does everything, and it's still not enough.
What do you mean by that?
Oh yeah, so the card is really easy to cast. It answers spells and abilities on a very unique axis by countering triggers and activations, which is stifles are not particularly common in that they're like three or four of them, but like really there are only two okay ones, and they're Trickbind and Stifle. Mm-hmm. The rest are not good.
Nimble Obstructionist, my goat.
Yeah, well, okay. But at least outside of those two, it's just kind of Tashana's Tidebinder, and it was new, it's cool, it's a 3/2 creature with flash, it does it on ETB, so it was a lot harder to interact with because it is a creature. You can cast it through like Ranger Captain of Eos, it's reanimatable, which if you can do something like with that at instant speed, that's awesome. So it ticks a lot of boxes. It permanently removes text from the cards that it stifles, which is kind of crazy. But it only removes it from artifacts and creatures and planeswalkers. So it can't do lands, and it can't do enchantments. It can stifle those triggers and activations, but it can't permanently remove the text from them, which is unfortunate because that card would have been the perfect answer for Rhystic Study. Perfect chance to answer Rhystic Study. But not that that card needs to be banned. I still disagree with that. But but I do think that it would have been fine to have a card that like answers it in a pseudo-permanent way. I think that it's aggressively statted. Nobody really wants to kill it if it's stifling, like perma-stifling something that's relevant, like a one ring or something like that. So it's not going to die, which means it basically reads unblockable in most regards. Makes it really optimal for sort of like Timna strategies as well as strategies that just want to push people's life totals. Mm-hmm. It does have flash, so it can just block things out of the blue. And I think I mentioned that it's really easy to cast at blue one. Blue two.
Blue two, yeah.
But it still does not do enough because it does not answer enchantments. And while triggers and activations are almost exclusively the way that people end up winning the game, because that's how you combo, is by repeatedly triggering or activating abilities or resolving a trigger that will win you the game. That specifically says win the game on it. The only difference is that like the card is so flexible because it answers so many things, but it's just, it's like three mana is just on the curve of playable interaction. Like it is playable, but it's like, do I really want to spend three mana for this? It's probably tapping me out. Like I can't cast another counter spell. I would rather just have an effect that counters the spell, except when there's a Ranger Captain cracked or when I need to be able to like resolve it through like a Force of Negation or a Fierce Guardianship or something that only counters non-creature spells. And so at that point, you're just like, you're still waffling. You're like, what are the chances that if the counter spell is going to hit the non-creature counter that, or the non-creature stifle, that it won't hit the creature stifle? And I mean, there are a fair number. It's like Swan Song for all those things, right? Only hit non-creature
spells. Yeah, good amount.
But at the same time, you're still stuck going, man, I could be playing just a more efficient card at 3 mana that'll like get me closer to winning the game, or like actively lock my opponents down harder, like all three of them at once. I could play another stacks piece, could play another advantage engine, could play a combo piece, a tutor. Like there are so many pieces in these categories, and Tashana just falls on like the really weak end of interaction. Even though the card just reads incredibly powerfully and does just get people sometimes.
I really like your explanation of it, because it's this card's incredible, this card's amazing, this card's expensive and just doesn't do quite enough. That's like the whole argument, is that whole split between this card's incredible, it's amazing, it does so many things, it costs 3 mana.
Absolutely.
You know what else also costs 2 blue? Rhystic Study. Fierce Guardianship technically has that printed in its text in its CMC cost. However, that spell says free. And I think for interaction specifically, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think 3 mana is such a big investment. It's so hard. Has to be able to do more than one thing. And it does. It covers a lot.
But it doesn't do enough more than one things.
Yeah. That's such a difficult, like, I think, conclusion to come to, and is probably part of the reason why we're seeing, like, clone effects just on the rise. Like, if you can jam, you know,
I don't want to spend a tutor and then have to go get my thing and then cast it when I can just have this clone that can, whoever casts it, I have it as well.
Exactly. So, like, Metamorph, for example, Phyrexian Metamorph has been on the rise basically ever since the One Ring got printed and started ruining our lives. And because of that, a lot of people have been kind of diving into, like, the whole clone space. Because, and this is something I've floated around a bunch, like, why would I play the, like, 11th or 12th best, like, creature that's tied to a removal spell, a la Tashana's Tidebinder, when you can just play a clone and take the next best thing that's on the board. It's evergreen, essentially. You're always going to have a live target for it, unless you're post-board wipe, but even still, Metamorph says artifact. You can always copy a Mana Crypt or Soul Ring or something.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, it's just one of those things where it's like, cards have to be flexible if they're going to cost, or just like game ending if they're going to cost like three or more mana, right? Like Ad Nauseas 5, it's game ending, like we play that card. Otherwise you're getting to like a little more fringe strategies, more off meta things where it's like, like this card might not mathematically technically be optimal, so we probably shouldn't play it, but this player says, but I think the card is really good and I'm going to play it anyways, because it may not be good 9 out of 10 times, but it may not be like the best cards that are good 9 out of 10 times. This card may only be good 8 out of 10 times, but those 8 out of 10 times, it's really good, or something like that. And I think the further you go, like, that lower that percentage gets, where, like, this card's only good 7 out of 10 times, 6 out of 10, and you get 5, like, and the card probably just shouldn't be playing the card.
Yeah. Or like those 8 times that show up are the 8 most frequent game states or situations you find yourself in.
Yeah, something like that. I think a really good example of this is like Beseech the Mirror. This card, like, yep. People popped yep. off about that card when it was spoiled and released, and the card does not show up that frequently. Like, ooh. I see it in like Grixis lists sometimes. I see it in Pivot lists sometimes. They got like lots of artifacts and tokens and stuff to bargain, but most of the time, like the decks that do play it, it's like it's pretty good. It's not the best tutor in their deck, but it's pretty good. But then like other lists, you're like, man, do I want to play Beseech the Mirror? Then you go, man, do I want to pay 3 black and 1 for a tutor that probably casts what I'm getting, but I'm getting a like a 5 costed thing like Ad Nauseas. It's not casting it. And if it gets countered, like, I've already sacrificed a thing, so now I'm hurt by that. And if I don't have something to sacrifice, or want something to sacrifice, or there's, like, a Dranid to play or something like that, then my card is actually just, like, a 4-mana terrible tutor. Do I really want to play that card? Because it's only good, like, 7 out of 10 times.
As someone who has sleeved up Beseech the Mirror, it is an incredible card. I have lost a dual caster mage being cast in response to it at least once. No, I see that. I think it's an interesting thought experiment because Beseech the Mirror is a very interesting card, but it's so contextual on the rest of your deck and the ease of which you can pay its additional costs. In some regards, I would call it like a perfectly designed like 2023 card. It's powerful, very powerful. It's not quite expensive, not quite too expensive at 4 CMC. 1 triple black hurts, but we're in a format where Dark Ritual exists, so it's alleviated at least a little bit. And it does have like a little bit of a deck building requirement. You need to be able to sacrifice something to it in order to gain like its full benefit.
Otherwise, it's just a bad tutor.
it's most of the time just a bad tutor. And in the deck that I played it in, I think it's still mostly correct. That deck just needs the consistency that it needs. Talking about DaBaby Pod here. But, like, that's where you go, okay, what are our payoffs? You know, the payoffs for the Baby Pod were, like, Culling Ritual, the One Ring, Birthing Pod were, like, the main targets for it. All game-ending super threats. All cards I want to see every game. So it provided consistency, and we were able to alleviate the extra costs of it just because the deck just shits out clues for breakfast. So we sacrificed a clue, whatever. Like, it was a draw that we were going to get later on in the game, so it really didn't matter. It's a resource we generated for ourselves. We're using the resource. But it is a tough card to, like, evaluate and look at, especially because of things like Dranith Magistrate, because of things like counter spells, where you are, if you're sacrificing a token, you're not quite 2-for-1-ing yourself. You're like 1.75-ing yourself, 1.5-ing yourself, sort of, kind of. I guess you can say 2-for-1 because it's a theoretical card draw, but that gets into the minutiae. That I do like Beseech the Mirror, though. It's a fun
it's
card.
A good
it's card. Great.
I think it's just another good example of those cards where it's like, it's good and you can play it. It is very playable. It's just like, is it good enough? Is what is the list that you're playing? Are you gonna play it? If yes,
play it. It's gonna be one of the best cards in your deck. But it's not. You're not gonna generically start a list with it.
Yeah. That's kind of where I was going. Was like, if you're playing the card, then it's gonna mesh well into the list, at least to some degree. But otherwise, your list is still going to be a little like off the meta, because that Koala card is strong, it's not as strong as other cards generically are.
For sure. Value engines get talked a lot. Talked a lot? They do get talked a lot. They also get talked about a lot as well. So if 3 mana is too expensive for a hyper-flexible, pseudo-hyper-flexible creature interaction spell, like, where is kind of the breaking point for, like, our value engines? Because I feel like Phyrexian Arena isn't playable in our format.
No, it's too slow.
It's too slow.
It does not do enough.
Even the better version of it, Black Market Connections, is seldom used.
I think, yeah, once the One Ring got printed, Connections is still doesn't do quite
enough. It really doesn't. Like, it's a decent slot out if you're not on Nauz and your curve is just a little bit too high for what you're doing. Think Kitatsugu and Kairi, that style of deck where you're just running too high of CMC cost, but the benefit's pretty good, so you can't really, like, make use of your life total that way. It's a good way to juice it. What makes a value engine CDH playable, then?
It probably just depends on what kind of value and, like, how your list is looking to abuse that. I think we'll just talk generically about card draw, because I think that's the most common by far. But then there are also other types of value that can be generated, like Smothering Tithe or Life with Shield through the Apocalypse and things like that. And those cards are also have, like, their own way of considering them. But we're just talking, like draw engines, because that's the most generic and type of advantage.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
I think there's the Holy Trinity, or, like, I guess at this point, the Holy Four cards. They're, like, Rhystic Study, Mystic Remora, the One Ring, and Talion, in no particular order.
I would say that's accurate.
All of those cards are incredibly strong. Rhystic Study and the Ring are just a little bit stronger than the other two, but that's only because Rhystic Study, for its cost, it does so much. It slows down your opponents, or it pushes you really far ahead. And in certain worlds, it does both. It pushes certain opponents really far behind and pushes you really far ahead from other opponents, which can be both. If it's doing both, it can be a positive or a negative. It's a little unpredictable, that card. The Ring, on the other hand, is, like, it's crazy.
It's so much value in a can.
It does ETB trigger immediately, does things, and the activation will draw you so many cards. I'm convinced that the Ring does draw more cards in a game where it's allowed to tap multiple times than a Rhystic Study will in that same game.
I think I can agree with that.
if your opponents, like, are at all competent, like, I think that's mostly how it works. The deal with Mystic Remora is that I think the card is also crazy strong. It's 1 mana. It draws cards on the most, like, basically the least restrictive card condition that you can set, which is non-creature spells, and your opponent has to pay 4 mana to stop that, which is almost unpayable most of the time. I think the only thing that holds that card back from just being strictly better than Rhystic Study is the fact that you have to pay a cumulative upkeep cost. So it's going to get more, it's going to get harder and harder to keep around each turn, especially if you're trying to advance your board state at all. So I think that that holds it back, like the cumulative upkeep holds it back just a little bit. That said, the card is crazy strong. It comes down earlier than Rhystic Study on average, so it will in certain pods draw you a lot more cards. And then I think, of course, there's the Talion, of course, is in there. Card's really hard to counter. Card draws a bunch of cards, punishes life totals, is a huge body. The only downside about that card is that it's a little more challenging to cast than the rest, and it's more expensive. So it's at 4 mana and it has 2 colored pips. But at the same time, your upside is crazy. And if you, it has a little bit more of a skill check where you have to figure out what the right number to name is going to be in any game in any pod. But if you can do that and figure out how to like pass the skill check, the card will just pay back in dividends.
It really does. It's, yeah. Mystic Remora is one of those cards that you will live and die by. It does so much, but it also is so capable of doing so goddamn little.
I have never kept a hand on a hope and a prayer of Mystic Remora, not drawn the land, and had to sacrifice after drawing no cards.
Oh my god, or you play the Mystic Remora seat one going, yes, finally, turn one, seat one fish, oh baby, it's easy street.
And everyone goes, guys, we'll play responsible, right?
Everyone goes, turn one land, dork, and you go, oh my god, what have I done?
Guys, we're all playing responsibly, right? No one's feeding this fish. You bet.
Yeah.
All right, land pass.
Land pass, baby. Got the land? Or are you hoping and praying? Yeah. No, I think I can agree with that assessment. Talion is such a good card.
Talion is a crazy strong card. I actually started tutoring for it more than Rhystic Study and the One Ring.
I think I need to start doing that. The games that I see Talion are so substantially different from the games that I don't see Talion. It's ridiculous.
Dude, the passive card draw effect plus the life loss, and also it's got that like old One Ring syndrome where people do not respect it. They're like, you casting a Talion? It's not the Rhystic Study, Mystic Remora, or the One Ring.
Ugh.
It's fine. You can have it. No one cares. It's just going to sit there. We'll kill it later. It's a creature. Easy to do, right?
Wait a minute. Why? Every time I cast any spell in my hand, I take 2 damage. Why is that? And you get to draw a card?
That's the thing. It's like 6 turns later, people are sitting there like, guys, how has someone not won yet? We've cast so many game-winning spells. And also, like, why are our life totals sub 10?
Wait, 14? What are you talking about?
Man, I don't know what you're talking about.
That's crazy,
counter
dude.
Counter spell after counter spell after counter spell after counter spell.
All your creatures say 2 toughness, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Or your rocks cost 2.
Yeah.
Or tutors cost 2. Or, yeah, it's just, or your interactive spells cost 1 and I set my Tommy at the 1. Like, dude, there's so much. So much.
Yeah, I never, like, I understood and respected how powerful Talion was just because I faced off against it a lot. Never in my life did I understand how good it feels to have a Talion on 2 and just be like, yep, this guy just lets me just get 40 cards in my hand.
No one respects him.
No one cares about it. I mean, I care about it. I hate Talions on the battlefield with a fiery passion, but I'm alone in that regard, it seems.
Yeah, it'll catch on. It'll be one of those things where like, oh, guys, this is a crazy powerful draw engine.
We should ban Talion.
Well, the thing about Talion is people often complain about Rhystic Study, but the thing that the other 3 cards do that Rhystic Study does not is say, you can't pay for this effect, I'm drawing the cards.
Mm-hmm.
And Rhystic Study, you do technically have the option to just pay 1 or not play a spell, which sometimes it doesn't matter. If someone turn 1's a Rhystic Study, yeah, it's pretty hopeless. But also if someone turn 1's a ring, yeah, it's pretty hopeless.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter. Same thing with Italian. I think, honestly, I'd much rather see a turn 1 Mystic Remora than a turn 1 Talion, Rhystic Study, or Ring any day of the
ever. Oh yeah, me too.
The
ceiling on that card is so big.
Has
so
to
big.
Die.
Yeah.
I just don't think that, like, Rhystic Study is a lot stronger if you get it, like, turn 3, turn 5, later game, it's a lot stronger. The Ring is less strong if you draw it after, if you get it into play after the mid game.
Mm-hmm.
But Talion's pretty good, basically anytime, and the fish is pretty good basically anytime. So I don't know. It's just like they all have strengths and weaknesses. I just hate it when everyone's like, guys, ban Rhystic Study, and no one's even ban Rissic City, ban Rissic Gamora, Mystic Gamora. No one's even talking about like the ring or Talion. Like, if you're gonna ban one, you should probably just ban all of them, because then what's the point of having like leaving two other crazy effective draw engines? And if you're gonna ban those, why not just like make it impossible for anyone to play anything other than Turbo Nauts as a strategy? Because there's no way to punish those decks effectively enough.
They also don't run good cards, as we've discussed.
So true. So true.
Well, I think that's a fantastic note to end on. Don't ban Rhystic, don't ban all the draw engines.
I would rather, like we posted on our Twitter, I would rather you ban like Mana Crypt and Sol Ring and all the fast mana. I think fast mana is the problem. It's not Rhystic Study. It's always the problem. Fast mana. Fast. Either ban fast mana, ban fetch lands, ban all cards with partner. If we're gonna do CDH ban hammer, let's do CDH ban hammer time. Ban all of the actually problematic things, and then basically just start a new format. But otherwise, guys, stop complaining. This isn't Flash, and yes, Flash is broken still. Have you seen that argument? People are saying, "Be like, oh,
wait,
Flash.
Is this an argument that people are like, Flash isn't that powerful?"
There's a contingent of people who are like, "Yeah, unban Flash. It's fine. There's a lot of free interaction to get there now, and Turbo needs the help." And you're like, "Guys, Turbo's not dead. It's just not meta dominant. Calm down." Next thing we need real stacks pieces so that mid range isn't meta dominant.
Correct.
Ay. It's not that hard, people. Just balance the format by printing cards. It just takes a little longer.
Yeah.
Banning is not the answer unless a card is actually a problem. Like
Flash. You realize that Flash says if you're in Simic, you get to win at any time for 2 mana if a spell resolves. Like, saying counterspell exists for these things is such a stupid argument. It's like, yes, every spell that says this spell cannot be countered or split second is theoretically counterspellable. Congratulations, you have understood the strength of counterspell. That's not reality.
Yeah, they don't always have the counterspell, which is why the Turbo contingent says send it. But also, like, they always have Flash, which is why everyone else says please leave that card on the ban list.
Never touch it. Never let it see the light of day. But do let Recurring Nightmare see the light of day. I am responsible. I promise.
Personally, I'm a Paradox lover. Let's unban that boy. He does nothing. He hurt nobody. He's just a 5 mana card that slows down the game.
I agree. Recurring Nightmare also does literally nothing except Dirtle. What? Don't read Dockside Extortionist ever in your life.
Yeah, nothing wrong there.
Nothing wrong there. Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. End the episode right there, Alice.
Nothing wrong there.
Yeah, fantastic conversation. This was a good one.
This was a good one.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. We'll catch you next time.